Guardian Unlimited.
I'm Matt Wells. This is Media Talk, the weekly podcast from the team that brings you Media Guardian. I've been to Broadcasting House for the reopening of the BBC's iconic headquarters by the Queen. But behind the regal smiles, what's the real story of this expensive refit? And what about the people she met, the BBC's expensive radio DJs? More embarrassing revelations, more questions about value for money. Plus comment from Chris Shaw, Steve Hewlett, Jeff Jarvis and Gareth McLean. The Queen and the BBC, two great British institutions, both 80 years old this year, but only one of them's had a facelift. Can you guess which one it is? All that scaffolding over there should be a clue. Her Majesty, you see, is here at Broadcasting House, she's just arrived actually, to perform the opening ceremony of phase one of its £800 million refit. She's meeting stars of BBC Radio, who are of course almost as well paid as she is. Chris Moyles is inside the building, so is Terry Wogan. The Guardian's not allowed anywhere near the Queen, of course, as we are confirmed Republicans. And it's probably just as well, as we're here to ask a few awkward questions, actually, since the project hasn't exactly been plain sailing. With me is Will Hurst. He's a reporter on Building Design, which is the weekly newspaper for architects. It's been following the story. Probably the biggest controversy, Will, was the sacking of the architect. Now, how did that come about?
Well, the architect on Broadcasting House was Richard McCormack, who's really got an impeccable reputation among British architects, former president of the Royal Institute of British Architects, won countless awards, nominated for the Stirling Prize a couple of years ago. But he actually got embroiled in a really big row behind the scenes over Broadcasting House. Some letters that we obtained under the Freedom of Information Act show that he was basically fighting for his designs for most of last year, and I think there was a kind of tension between his creative vision for the project and the need for the BBC to remain on budget.
Yeah, you mentioned the budget there because it's an £800 million project, as I say, £20 million so far it's overrunning, and the BBC was clearly concerned that to keep it in budget, but as you've shown, the architect was concerned to preserve the artistic integrity of his project against the bean counters.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, on an £800 million project like this, and one that's incredibly complex in terms of the kind of technical specifications and the fact that it's a listed building and it's surrounded by other listed buildings, I don't think a £20 million cost overrun is all that great. And the other thing to remember is that the specifications have also changed on the project, and another listed building was brought in as part of it, and also after September the 11th, security concerns meant that designs had to alter. So I don't think that's a great cost overrun.
And indeed, just round the corner from where we're standing is Oxford Circus, big tube line interchange, and two tube lines run not very far underneath where we're standing and right under Broadcasting House itself, which itself presents enormous technical problems.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, one of the things that they needed to do was to raise the level of Broadcasting House and install some enormous springs to minimise vibrations from the tubes passing underneath. So a very, very difficult challenge, I think, and certainly some of the key parts of Richard McCormack's vision, which he wanted to maintain, were kind of gradually taken away, I guess, by the client, the BBC, and their main builder, Bovis, on cost grounds.
For example?
Well, I think one of the main ones that McCormack was complaining about in his letters to some of the highest people, like the chairman and then the director general at the BBC, were things like his vision for the newsroom within Broadcasting House, which he kind of wanted to be a kind of iconic symbol for the BBC, with these great pillars which would form the backdrop to every TV news broadcast the BBC did. That was scrapped. You know, because of the kind of process going on to cut costs at the BBC, McCormack, you know, kept complaining about these sort of things going on, and eventually was dropped from the project and replaced by a big commercial firm who are now going to take on phase two.
replaced, I understand, by Bovis, the contractors. Now,
Bovis are the contractors, they remain, yes. But a new commercial firm of architects has been brought in, Shepherd Robson. But yes, the decision to do that was taken by Bovis, yeah.
Now, amongst other things, amongst other comment that we've heard about this project has been some controversy over the public art. Tell us about that.
Well, I think, the BBC's commissioned a lot of new public art recently. It's obviously involved in some very large building projects across the UK, and public art's a big part of that. One of the most controversial, I think, and one of the most costly has been the structure on top of the new wing of Broadcasting House, which is called Breathing. It's by a Spanish architect, and it's a kind of enormous glass cone which projects light into the sky. And it's those kind of things which certainly have had a kind of mixed reaction and show the difficulties, I think, that the BBC has in providing value but also trying to strive for creative excellence.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary piece of art, actually. As you say, the idea is to shoot a column of light into the air at the start, I think, of the 10 o'clock news every night from this cone on top of the new part of Broadcasting House, which would reflect in some way the names of journalists who have died in the course of their work. It cost £900 million and was described by the critic on your paper actually as possibly the most misconceived piece of art, yeah. Public art in London of all time. But you mentioned value for money, and there is a lot of analysis and comment about the BBC's what it spends on architecture and on its buildings and property, and MPs have been critical of other aspects of the BBC's property portfolio, haven't they?
Yeah, that's right. You can see why there is this pressure on the BBC, but Broadcasting House is certainly not the only project which comes under this scrutiny and where there's been these kind of rows between client and architect. The BBC has been heavily criticised for its White City developments, for example, and going back to the tensions between, the architecture and the need to provide value for money. Broadcasting House needs to be seen in the context of the new BBC Scotland building in Glasgow, where the BBC's had a big row with the architect David Chipperfield, another kind of leading light among architects in this country. Again, he felt that his designs were being compromised. A commercial practice was brought along and were changing things that he was very unhappy with. Another example, I guess, would be the Music Box, a very exciting kind of music building that the BBC commissioned at White City using an international competition in 2003. We've heard no more about that. It's just gone completely quiet. Nobody knows if the project's even going ahead.
And what does this say about the BBC generally as a client of architects?
I think there's a feeling among architects and in the sort of wider design community that the BBC... really the balance has swung too much in favour of the bean counters at the BBC and the bottom line, and that the really kind of visionary, exciting people at the BBC who were trying to commission this great architecture have been sidelined. 3 years ago you'd probably say that the BBC would have been voted one of the great architectural clients in this country. In the context of the three projects I've just mentioned, they're still seen as a good client, but nothing like the kind of client they were seen as.
The Guardian podcast, sponsored by Volvo. The all-new Volvo C70 invites you to feel. Open up and hear what's driving the creative minds of the world.
So a sorry story behind the pomp and ceremony down at Broadcasting House. Many thanks to Will Hurst of Building Design for talking us through it. So Emily Bell is off, I'm afraid, this week on holiday, but we have Chris Shaw here in the podcast studio. Chris Shaw, Senior Programming Controller at Five. Hello to you.
Hi, Matt.
And Steve Hewlett is back from holiday. Did you have a nice holiday?
Very nice, thank you.
Okay. While you've been away, there's been a lot of talk about BBC presenter salaries. And we talked about it last week, but there have been more revelations this week with the Radio 2 lot now. Somebody's sitting somewhere, aren't they, with a big fat pile of presenter salaries, which they seem to be leaking to selective newspapers and probably making quite a lot of money out of.
Could be a disgruntled agent trying to force up his clients or her clients' salaries.
Although it's unlikely that any single agent would know all this because they're all represented by different people. What I think's happened is, at some point in the last 18 months, there's been a rumble at the BBC about presenter salaries. Somebody very important has said, I demand to know precisely what we are paying all these people. Someone has gone away to different directorates, ferreted around in the cupboards and come up with one list of all the salaries. And it's been presented at a meeting, and that list is in someone's possession.
Good thinking. Yeah, I actually have some intelligence on that. I happen to know at least one senior BBC figure who's summoned in a number of agents and told them that all their clients are overpaid and that no one is quite worth what they're currently being paid. Yeah. I'm not going to tell you which directorate, but I think there is a mood about presenter salaries generally, not just at the BBC, but across the industry. And yeah,
I think for public service broadcasters, this is a kind of little dirty secret. Really, you know, everyone in the business has known all along that, you know, presenters can get paid, you know, what appears to, certainly to ordinary punters and by any standards, very, very large amounts of money. Why Terry Wogan should get more than the Director General, for a radio show on Radio 2, or us, naturally, yeah. This is quite hard for public service broadcasters.
And just for the uninitiated, we're talking about Terry Wogan was said to be on 800,000, Chris Moyles at Radio 1 on 630,000. They're all in the, you know,
Jonathan Ross reported
15 million.
Being on 720,000 for his radio show. Then of course there's his TV show,
yes,
which he's probably getting 50k a throw for 26 episodes. So he's taking several million pounds out of the BBC.
So are these salaries justified, Steve? And how do you explain them in the marketplace?
Well, I think you have to distinguish. You can't take them all in one go. I think in television, you know, salaries can be very high, but there is a real market. It might be a balmy market, but it's like footballers. You know, there is a market for the best talent, but it is a market. ITV will pay this, the BBC will pay that, and if you want to play in that game, You have to play the market game. So some salaries, some pay, some fees will be very high. For some of them, very high indeed. In the radio sphere, there are very few other places that these people can actually go. There are one or two slots on commercial radio which can command really big money, like Capital Breakfast, Chris Tarrant, £1 million plus. Right. So if you want Chris Tarrant, and that's what he's doing, you've got to pay the rate. But quite why you have to pay Jonathan Ross that much money, or Terry Wogan, or endless other people, that's hard.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, big name poaching, of course, goes on in the newspaper world as well. And the Mail, it's been announced this week, has finally wooed columnist Tom Utley away from the Telegraph. But there's a funny thing here, Steve, isn't there, that sometimes people who work well in one newspaper don't work so well in another. We've had Richard Littlejohn, of course, who's moved from the Sun to the Mail. And he, I don't know, it just doesn't seem quite right, does it?
Well, just as a reader, I've not studied this, and I dare say that the commercial people in newspapers can work out how many readers or advertising pounds, you know, follow this columnist or that columnist. But it's very rare that people simply change newspapers and straight away feel the same. There's an example at The Guardian and The Times, actually. David Aronovich, who I should say is an old colleague of mine, I was an avid reader of his in The Guardian. It all seemed to fit quite right. He has a dissident view. I thought it was very interesting, the rest of it. Do I buy The Times to read him? Actually, no, I don't. If I stumble across it, I'll read him. In reverse, Simon Jenkins, in The Times, this is again just as purely as a reader, it felt kind of just right, just so on and so on and so on. In The Guardian, I don't know, it doesn't quite do it. I still read him when I've got time, but it's not a kind of must read. So I'm not sure that columnists are easily in any simple way, you know, excisable from their context.
As an outsider from the world of print, it looks quite tribal belonging to a newspaper in a way, more so almost than, you know, having an exclusive contract with the BBC or something like that. So when a big name columnist moves or gets dumped or whatever or poached, I suspect that there's a lot of kind of personal pride involved for the people who are poaching them, and that it's kind of a scalp and it's kind of knocking the other guy to bring in one of their stars. But I noticed that there's something running today, I think, about Griff Rhys-Jones being dumped by Patience Wheatcroft. That's kind of interesting too. I thought he was classic Telegraph, but apparently not classic enough.
But it's a bit of a divergence, but there is something else going on here between the Telegraph and the Mail, it seems to me, which is that you know, they're both after each other's markets. The Mail think they've got an opportunity to build on their kind of broad mid-market, slightly upmarket female readership, right, and begin to really colonise, you know, what you might call the respectable right-wing conservative market, which is traditionally the Telegraph, and that's why he's going for Utley, and that's why other people have swapped places.
A bit like the Tory party, actually.
But meanwhile, the Telegraph, I think, sees its salvation in finding a home amongst this broad mid-market, slightly upmarket female readership that is so beholden, that is so much the Daily Mail. The BBC went through a phase of this, desperately trying to emulate the Daily Mail. Michael Jackson, one of the BBC controller of note of some years ago, and formerly chief editor of Channel 4, was reputed always to be walking around the BBC with a copy of the Daily Mail under his arm. Now, that's not far from true, because he stumbled across the fact that the Daily Mail really, really understood their audience in a way that most people in the BBC didn't.
And that's an interesting note on which to end. More from our panel shortly. Time to check in with our man in America, Jeff Jarvis. And Jeff, you've got news of a remarkable piece of cost-cutting at a newspaper in Minneapolis.
Well, Matt, the folks there can no longer get the newspaper. There are very few fringe benefits to working on a paper. One is that you get the paper for free, and the other one is that you get an obit when you die. But the first benefit has gone away.
Right.
And I guess an argument could be made that if you work at a restaurant, you don't get free food. But clearly reading our own paper is a good idea. What it really shows, though, is the utter lack of strategic direction of newspapers in America.
I was going to ask you about the bigger picture.
Yeah, they really can't get to the point of trying to make the business work by doing that level of cost cutting. In fact, to the contrary, they have to find bigger things to cut. At the same time, they find new and big things to invest in.
Yeah, because, I mean, at this paper in Minneapolis, instead of, you know, normally in newspapers where we work, we usually pick up the copy as you go in the office in the morning. But here, they're asking the members of staff to pay to take the newspaper out of their, you know, distribution bins or whatever. But this is, I mean, it can't be saving that amount of money. And they must be pretty desperate if they're, you know, if they've got down to that kind of level.
But that's where I think the industry is in America.
Yeah,
and it's sad. The problem now is there's more stockholder pressure on more media companies after the sale of Knight Ridder, and I think we're going to see more of this kind of blind cost cutting. Again, I think costs do need to be cut. We don't need to send 15,000 journalists to the conventions where nothing happens. Yeah. We don't need to send golf critics all around to golf tournaments everywhere when you can watch it on TV. But we do need to invest in new ways to do things, and this is not going to save journalism.
Are there any, you know, we've had a lot of bad news from the regional press, both in Britain and in America. Are there any people over there who are visionary, who do see the way things are going, and who are making changes that you think, you know, are the way forward?
There are some. Full disclosure is that I'm talking to you from an office of the New York Times Company, so I'll have to make them present company excluded, but they're doing some good things. The Washington Post is doing some good things, but no. And I'm going to be risk being terribly sycophantic right now, but the example that I give in the world is The Guardian.
Hmm.
I think The Guardian is the paper that I've seen. Alan Rusbridger told me when I came to talk to a group there that the Berliner presses that you just bought may well be the last presses you ever order. And that's a phrase that won't come from the mouth of an American editor unless keeling over and dying. They can't imagine a world after paper. The Guardian and very few others in the world are trying to imagine that world and get to it.
Now, there are a few other words that won't be coming from the mouths of, well, broadcasters in particular, because a few weeks ago you told us of this plan by media regulators in America to ban certain words from the airwaves. You were very angry about that. I hear there have been developments in your campaign.
Yes, the huge fines that came out with the latest batch of FCC fines and the upgrading of the S word and all its variants to profane status, which is a worse legal view, finally have gotten the broadcast networks to fight back. They have not fought back since the mid-70s, really, and they've always gone along with the FCC for fear of the FCC's actions in other business matters.
Yeah.
But finally now they have all filed suit, a complaint with the FCC and banded together to do this, and I think it's a great thing. The other day, last week I wrote about trying to save bullshit as a political word in The Guardian, and I might fear now that my gravestone, my obit in the newspaper will say, he saved bullshit.
Will you be appearing as a witness in the case?
I would love to. I tried to testify before the U.S. Senate Commerce Committee about the FCC regulations, but that's a very controlled and closed environment, and you don't get there unless you are invited there to say what they want you to say.
Well,
so much for tra- transparency.
Well, quite. Well, we'll keep tabs on this latest development. And before we go, Jeff, before we go on, I'd like to bring in the comments of one of our listeners. Now, this is Noodle Pie, a.k.a. Graham Holiday. He's a blogger. He went to blogs.guardian.co.uk/podcasts to say that he very much enjoyed our podcast. He thought it was fun. But he's got a suggestion, Jeff, which is to have two edits. He quite fancies having a short and snappy version and then a lengthier one with full-length version, he says, of the interviews that we feature. He says, surely Jeff Jarvis is worth slightly more than a minute or two. So you've got a fan.
Oh, shucks. But see, actually, the speed with which I talk, I can get 5 minutes in 1 minute.
Exactly. Well, with that in mind, and for Graham and for all your other fans, tell us what you're writing about in your Media Guardian column this week.
It's actually hard to summarize in 10 seconds, but I'll try. The question I'm asking is whether the Internet has an inherent political worldview. There was a wonderful column by Justin Webb, a BBC correspondent online, in which he argued that the American left has lost its way, because mass media was how they got their message out, and now mass media is mass no more. And I thought about that and said, well, you know, actually the next media phenomenon that came along, talk radio and cable news, became the perfect media for American conservatives. They used that niche media to bash their messages over their audience. So then I asked, well, what is the political nature of the latest medium, of the Internet? And I wonder, when I started blogging in 2001, I saw what I think is a disproportionate number of libertarians around. Hmm. And that puzzled me at first. But then it finally occurred to me that this is, after all, the medium that enables and celebrates individual liberty. Everybody can do whatever they want, and that's what libertarians are, in a simplified view, about. But then this last week, I read the Houston Manifesto at Comment is Free, the Guardian's group blog site, in which Norm Garris and other bloggers came out with a new Democratic Progressive Alliance manifesto with a lot of points that I happen to agree with, a lot of flags I happen to salute. And, of course, then there was a whole bunch of controversy at Comment is Free and in other blogs about that. One blogger at Comment is Free called it a remarkably pompous, vague, and prolix declaration. Now, you might think that that's just the Internet doing what people think the Internet is doing, which is to become an echo chamber. But yeah. This was not left against right. This was left against left. And it occurs to me that what the Internet really enabled people to do here was to splinter off and find other like-minded people, and they met in a pub on Houston, and they wrote their manifesto. And I'm not sure that could have happened before. So I'm not sure that the Internet necessarily has a political worldview except to remake the political worldview.
Sounds very interesting, although goodness knows what pub they went to in Houston, because they're all spitting sort of dives around there. Anyway,
well, that's what the left is left to.
Well,
yes.
I suppose so, exactly. Thanks very much, Jeff. Speak to you soon.
Thank you, Matt.
Jeff Jarvis is a prominent blogger. He blogs at buzzmachine.com. And speaking about this subject, there's been an interesting piece of research from the British Market Research Bureau, it says here, about the influence of bloggers. It actually says that they have a disproportionately loud voice, Steve. It says that in effect we could pay too much attention to them.
I suppose it's the thing of the moment, isn't it? I'm never sure whether quite how much value one gets. Well, sorry, let me put it the other way. The idea that blogs simply replace or supplant, you know, journalism, written journalism in other forms, I think is just wrong. They can do something different, which is they can report in almost real time in ways that in print is very rare. It's almost traditional now in television. It's got 24-hour news. In radio, it's got 24-hour news. You know, internet, so on and so on. So being able to get, you know, the words of Polly Toynbee kind of as and when it happens, because she happens to be there, you know, that's kind of quite interesting. Nevertheless, Polly Toynbee delivers, and others deliver, really quite high quality stuff, especially when they've had time to think about it and mulch all the evidence and so on and so on and so on. And then you're getting a kind of something much higher octane. So the idea that blogs simply replace the rest, I think, is wrong, because by definition, you know, there's no time for reflection.
What do you think, Chris?
I citizen journalism is very de nojure of the moment, and according to the article I read, only sort of 2% of internet users ever bother reading or placing a blog, which is not very many.
Thank you very much, Steve Hewlett and Chris Shaw. Gareth McLean is next.
Further entertainment can be found behind the wheel of the new Volvo C70. Visit www.volvocars.co.uk.
Time to end with our usual bit of back chat from Gareth, Gareth McLean here. Hello.
Full of compliments today, aren't you?
Yes, it's been a bit of a masculine podcast so far. I've just realised that we haven't had any ladies on.
Oh, no. Do you want me to tuck my bits back between my legs?
Gareth, you're obviously just a bit too far. Now, we should read out a few more comments. Yes. We've had quite a lot of those.
It's nice people are listening at all, in fact.
Well, we particularly like Roy Preston. Now, he emailed media@guardian.co.uk to say it's an excellent podcast, second only to Point of Inquiry, whatever that is. Don't know. Now, if only our Nancy Banks-Smith could be tempted to read out her unrivaled TV criticisms.
Oh, she'd have to put her teeth in.
That's a bit nasty about Nancy. Now, not so nice about us was Ian, who went to blogs.guardian.co.uk/podcasts to say this. He enjoyed the first three podcasts hugely, a highlight, he said. But the latest episode, though, descended after the discussion re BBC salaries into the worst kind of gaggle of lovies giggling over inside jokes and tabloidy gossip.
Well, as I was saying to Alan Yentob only the other day...
I can't pick.
Sorry, is it Ian, your name? It's sorry, Ian, we'll try not to do that.
Just, okay.
Yeah, no, just trying to be funny.
Well, we are just trying to be funny, yeah. But perhaps...
Light relief.
The light relief at the end. We've also had the other exciting thing, which we asked last week to get people to send in, their voices, to record, so you can record on your computer at home onto an MP3 file your letter or comment or whatever it is you want to say, insult or proposition for the presenters.
Yeah, more of those. Presenting propositions, send pictures attached.
Okay. And Daniel Cram actually did. I didn't think we'd get any, but wow. But he did. And this is his, well, I don't know what you call it, but Run VT.
Run VT.
Dear me, Media Guardian, I got used to devoting a good amount of Monday morning to you. Then Comet is Free came along and I spent time there too. Then you came up with Media Talk, and of course I listen every week. And now you even encourage me to send in my own recordings. Apropos time, I'm wondering if, besides all the blogging and podcasting they're all asked to do now, Guardian journalists actually still find time to write stuff for that old-fashioned thing, The Guardian.
Good point, well made there.
Absolutely.
But that's, of course, why we made all the pictures bigger in the paper, isn't it? So we wouldn't have to write as much. Silly man.
Anyway,
thank you for your contribution. And it wasn't VT, was it? It was like hard drive or something.
I don't know what the equivalent new media term for Run VT is. Didn't he have a nice voice?
You're doing your job. Are you qualified?
Didn't he have a nice voice too?
He did, yes. It was a really good treat. I wonder where he was from. Was there a note at the end?
Didn't
he's
say
not from Wembley like the lady from last week.
No, he's not. No, I think he might be from abroad, but I think he might be studying in Britain. A student. Anyway, but interestingly, we're talking about blogs and things,
yeah.
And people making comments. Mm-hmm. People have been making some nice comments about us, one or two nasty comments. Lots of people have been making very nasty comments about Chris Evans.
Yes, on his board. Yeah, well, he started to take over from Drive Time from Johnny Walker, yeah. Who's gone off to, I don't know, Pastures New or possibly a euthanasia farm, I don't know.
Nowhere like that.
Nowhere like that. Yes, and almost everyone who can be bothered to comment on the BBC Radio 2 message boards have disliked Chris Evans. Yeah.
Would you pay any attention to what people said about you on The Guardian blog, for example?
Well, I'm very thin-skinned, yes. I would if they attached their pictures, like I said before. Do that, and then we can talk.
Okay. Dynasty is back.
It is, yes. They're doing a TV reunion, and the pictures, very strange pictures, because obviously John Forsyth, who played Blake Carrington, is like a little old man, like a California raisin.
He was really old.
He was old anyway, I know. He's probably starting to come down again. But Linda Evans, yes. No, is it Linda Evans? Linda Gray. Linda Evans. And Joan Collins. I was going to call her by a character name. I know it's not real. Okay. But they actually, younger than they did in the 80s. Which obviously that's just like sneaky camera work and not anything else.
Not anything else, because they haven't had
that. No. They were in a wind tunnel when they had the pictures.
Maybe they were. So that's quite exciting, but that's not the only soap. That's
well, you
back.
See, just the dearth of good ideas in Hollywood, that they're remaking Dallas as a movie.
Da-da.
Keep going.
No.
You weren't very sure there. Yeah, well, I'm not very keen on the Dallas one because John Travolta is going to play JR Shirley MacLaine's going to play Miss Ellie. That's quite funny. Yes. Priscilla Bewley Presley won't be returning as Jenna Wade. But Sue Ellen, Jennifer Lopez.
Oh no.
That's ridiculous.
It's just stupid. No, thank you.
What about the Jennifer Lopez of Canary Wharf? Do you know who we're talking about?
Oh, I thought Dominic Lawson had been sacked.
He can't be.
You mean Patience, don't you?
Patience Wheatcroft.
Dear Patience, yes. She's made her first swinging cut at the Sunday Telegraph by offing Griff Rhys-Jones.
Yes, well...
Who doesn't need the money, so no. It's not like he's going to be destitute.
Were you a Griff Rhys-Jones fan?
Oh, yes, massively. Well, you know, he was quite good on Not the 9 o'clock News, I've heard. I'm too young for that, obviously. But yes, well, you know, Patience, if you're looking for a hilarious new columnist, I am available.
Just don't hire him before we've finished this run of media podcasts. Thank you very much, Gareth MacLaine. Thank you very much to all my other guests today who have been, if I can remember them, Steve Hewlett and Chris Shaw and Jeff Jarvis. If you want to send more of your MP3 files like Daniel Cram did, record them on your computer, save them, and then send them to us on media@guardian.co.uk. Put podcast in the subject line. If you want to comment, you can go to blogs.guardian.co.uk/podcast. There'll be more media talk soon. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Guardian Unlimited.